Energy Environment to order. And we're going to have a slight change in the agenda today. And we're going to start with House Bill 2711. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2711 and give the gavel over to my vice chair. And if the first panel can come on up, we'll give our presentation.
I'll guess the group here.
You can run the computer.
Appreciate that. I'm sure he'll give all your bills a hearing.
So, Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee, for your record, Ken Helm, State Representative for House District 34. House Bill 2711 is a fairly simple bill. It imposes a moratorium on hydraulic fracking throughout the entire state of Oregon until December 31st, 2027. And I'll address an amendment in a moment that in part accomplishes that 2027 date. For the new members of the committee, in 2015 I brought a similar bill, and after discussion with committee members, I went a different direction with that bill, in that it was my thought that if we are going to ever allow hydraulic fracking in the state, that we should have rules and regulations that ensure that our land and water is protected as that activity is occurring. And so, based on feedback from the committee, I went off and amended my bill to attempt to give the Department of Geology and Industries, DOGAMI, authority to do rulemaking along those lines. The fiscal on that ended up being some $750,000. We passed the bill out of the committee, and it went down to the Ways and Means, where the co-chairs decided we could use that money somewhere else. So, it is my belief, and I think it's shared by some of my colleagues and many of our constituents, that hydraulic fracking in the state needs to be very tightly regulated if we allow it at all. And so this bill comes back and says we need to impose a moratorium, at least for the next 10 years, until we find out if we have entities that want to come and do that type of business here. If we see that they do, we can engage again in the conversation about whether we should do rulemaking to make sure that it's safe. There is a dash one amendment to House Bill 2711. The first amends line five to change the date to December 31st, 2020, from 2026 to 2027, so that we have a true 10-year moratorium. And then at line 14, that provision exempts from the moratorium or the prohibition coal bed extraction wells that were in existence at the time in 2015. There were a handful of exploratory wells drilled down near Coos Bay. They were in process. Folks had put some money into it and some science into it to determine whether some coal bed methane extraction could occur down there. And I wanted to carve those folks out of the moratorium because they'd already started it. And, of course, we would be changing the rules, and that wouldn't be fair. And so I intend to still abide by that goal. And therefore, line 14 needs to be amended slightly to identify that the coal bed methane extraction wells that were in existence at the time of adoption of this bill, if it passes, will be subject to that exemption. Otherwise, I think either on OLIS or in front of you, you have a map of where our potential frackable lands are in the state. They're not where you might have guessed. They're predominantly in the Willamette Valley, and then moving off into our coastal regions as we move south, and in and around Coos Bay. And I think my colleagues are going to talk a little bit more about what it means to their constituents that some of these underground resources lie beneath above ground resources that we value very much in this state. So I'll leave it there and hand it over to my colleagues to make their comments.
Madam Vice Chair, committee members, my name is John Lively. I'm House District Rep from District 12, which is Springfield. I'm pleased to be here today to speak to you about House Bill 2711. So this is an issue I've followed for several years, and I don't intend to be an expert about it, but followed what's going on nationally and some of the impacts, some of what we know about it and some of what we don't. And in doing that, I've also engaged with some of my constituents who asked questions and raised concerns about it, about the potentials of it ever occurring in Oregon, and if it did, how would we regulate it? So that brought me to this point of considering what this might do. And while I appreciate opinions vary about this technique and where it's at or where it's not, I had several concerns that brought me to the point that I think a moratorium at this point makes sense. So the first of those, and Representative Helm talked about that earlier, is the location of the potential reserves that this technique could be used on. And they're not in remote areas. They're in the Willamette Valley, and that in many cases could be near where the population centers are. And so there's a concern for many about where just those deposits are. And I think that's surprising to a lot of people of where that might be versus where we might expect it to be. Secondly, having read a lot about other areas, and specifically in Oklahoma and places, and knowing that as a state and certainly as a region in the western part of Oregon, we're very suspect to the earthquake. So if a major earthquake were to occur, the damage that would do, and there is some evidence that some of the techniques and things that occur around fracking intensify or create other potential earthquakes. And so that concerns me to understand more what that relationship might be, especially when we're planning for what could be a catastrophic earthquake on the Oregon coast. Third is the risk, the potential risk to groundwater. Many of the communities in the valley get their community water from wells, and the communities, it's not just the communities, it's most of the farmers and other people take their both their irrigation water and, in the case of the communities, our drinking water from wells. And so we have concerns about over the long-term fracking and what that might do to the groundwater or put into the groundwater and the impact on those wells, and I think those are things we just need to understand and know more of. And finally, most recently, I've become more concerned based on conversations I've heard nationally about changing the standards regarding miles per gallon and which way we're heading from a standpoint of less dependence upon certain types of fuels. And that concerns me when the policies may be changing that might create an atmosphere where there'd be more explorations and that looking for it because there might be more opportunities for it. So for me and for what the constituents and I have talked about, we just think it's time to say let's put it a moratorium on it. Let's, if indeed the opportunity rises that there seems to be more chance to do this, let's do it right and let's talk about it, but let's not wait until we have to and be behind that. So thank you for your consideration.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tana Sanchez. I'm the House Representative for District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I want to talk to you today just a little bit about maybe my history as an environmentalist, and recognizing that I'm coming at this not actually having done a whole lot of research, but I was amazed and surprised by the where the possibilities to do this fracking is, and of course, thinking about it from that very much of that environmental standpoint. But then I look at so many other pieces of it. My significant other is from Oklahoma. He's a Cherokee tribal member, and we get messages every couple of months maybe, but they tell us it's happening all the time, that the earthquakes are happening all the time, small earthquakes, bigger earthquakes, all around 4 or 5, something like that, and that they feel them for hundreds of miles. And I think about that, and then when I heard that this is a possibility here, I thought, oh my God, what could we possibly be thinking? As I sit down there in public safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and the Office of Emergency Management tells me that I asked him, you know, are we ready for the Cascadia earthquake if it happens? What does it look like? And he says, you know, he starts explaining the things about bridge and infrastructure and all that. And I said, no. I'm asking you, if an earthquake hits, if that earthquake, any earthquake hits here in Oregon, are we ready? Are you, you know, tents, food, water, anything? He said, we're telling people 2 weeks. Be prepared to take care of yourself for 2 weeks. That scared the hell out of me. Three. Yeah, minimally, 2 weeks, though. And I think about something like this right along the I-5 corridor where the majority of our communities, I mean, the population lives. And if in Oklahoma they're feeling earthquakes hundreds of miles away, and we don't have buildings that can sustain themselves, brick buildings, we have very old brick buildings in my area that will not sustain earthquake damage. Now, I was in Portland working at a DV shelter when a 4.3, I think, hit. And they were laughing at us in California. But a big chunk of the wall fell out in the basement of that shelter. That means that our buildings are not ready for anything like that. And if Oklahoma is experiencing this on a regular basis, what on earth are we thinking about doing to ourselves by allowing something like that to happen? So again, my real environmentalist hat, I don't think so. I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think we are prepared. I don't think Oklahoma was prepared for what they're dealing with now. Now, they've got their land base is, you know, they're more spread out. Their infrastructure is probably different. They're not as high rise as we are. I don't think that, I mean, they're not happy about it either. And they know very well, and the news actually says it is from the fracking. They're actually saying that. So I just want us to really think about that, really consider those issues, and pay attention to the fact that we have an opportunity to say, no, let's see if we can even get anywhere near figuring out whether or not this is safe for us before we make any decisions about doing something like this. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so the... Do you want to just take this back? Is it good?
Can I invite up Angela Crowley-Cook, Paige Spence, and Rhett Lawrence, Max Muller, here too. To get you up next, Max. These are the first three on my list. Go right ahead when you're ready. And remember, we've got I've got 5 bills to get through today, so if we can make it quick, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Chair Hill, and members of the committee. My name is Angela Crowley-Cook. I'm the Legislative Director at Oregon Environmental Council, and I will be brief. Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 2711, imposing a moratorium on hydraulic fracturing in Oregon in order to safeguard our water resources. And we support the -1 amendment as described by Representative Helm. There are two safe water concerns that we have. First of all, fracking uses an enormous amount of water. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, fracking uses on average over 2 million gallons of water per well. And those are just averages. In some cases, it's quite a lot more. And then there's the concern about the quality of the water that is used in fracking. Most of the water is too tainted for other productive uses. Up to 600 chemicals may be used in fracking, including known carcinogens and toxic chemicals such as formaldehyde, lead, and mercury. In total, around 40,000 gallons of chemicals are used in fracking. wastewater is either reinjected into the ground or held in containment pools. And that's where the concerns arise about contaminating drinking water. According to ProPublica, there have been over 1,000 documented cases by courts, as well as state and local governments of contamination next to areas of gas drilling. In Oregon, over 70% of Oregon residents get their drinking water from groundwater, with over 90% of the state's public water systems drawing from groundwater as well. And so for these reasons, in order to protect our water resources, we urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm and committee members. My name is Paige Spence, and I am here today representing the Oregon League of Conservation Voters in support of House Bill 2711 with the -1 amendment. HB 2711, as amended, would put in place a 10-year moratorium on the hydraulic fracturing, otherwise known as fracking, of wells used for exploration or development in Oregon. And I think it's great that the moratorium doesn't preclude fracking forever. Instead, it provides the legislature with 10 years to determine how to proceed on the issue. OLCV believes that House Bill 2711 is a reasonable and forward-thinking measure that will allow the state of Oregon and our communities and counties sufficient time to help develop a regulatory framework for fracking that could prevent impacts on human health and the environment. In the decade or so since fracking began booming nationally, we've seen drilling operations contaminate drinking water, as Angela mentioned, pollute air, and threaten the health of nearby residents. Nationally, fracking has created hundreds of billions of gallons of toxic wastewater and over 100 million metric tons of global warming pollution since 2005, and that's not to mention the nearly incalculable land degradation. So in short, we are grateful to Rep. Helm for bringing this bill that helps Oregon get out in front of this issue, and we can act now to safeguard our air, our water, our natural spaces, and public health. Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the conservation director for the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. And on behalf of our more than 20,000 members across the state here to strongly support House Bill 2711 and the -1 amendment. You've heard eloquently stated already what the bill will do, what the concerns are, and you know I hear from my members around the state. They hear what fracking is doing in other states, and are I think rightly concerned about what kind of impacts that could have here in Oregon. So, you know, and again, since this bill doesn't impact any current operations, but just gives us the time to assess what fracking could bring to our state if it were to happen, I think this is a sensible and reasonable, moratorium to give us time to sort out what fracking could do. So we strongly support this bill and urge this committee to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Next up, Max Muller, Julia, and Claudia, please. So we'll get to you next.
Okay.
Whoever's ready, go right ahead.
Chair Helm and committee members, I'm Claudia Keith. I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon, testifying in favor of House Bill 2711, which imposes a moratorium on the use of hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking. Please refer to my written testimony, which includes a recommendation to add a new coal bed methane drilling to the proposed moratorium. Our testimony is in support of House Bill 2711 is consistent with the League's national positions to preserve the physical, chemical, and biological integrity of the ecosystem with a focus on demanding pollution prevention and ensuring justice and public safety for all people. Our recommendation is in consideration of the following facts detailed in my written testimony. Please refer to the New York State fracking environmental study that supports their moratorium. That comprehensive study addresses serious issues in a number of categories, including drinking water, seismic activity, climate change, soil contamination, the community, and health complaints. On the topic of climate change, I would like to remind the committee that the League of Women Voters of Oregon clearly supports net zero greenhouse gas emissions before 2050 by implementing an 8% annual greenhouse gas emission reduction starting now. California and several other states have had problematic underground aquifer contamination issues caused by fracking-related waste materials illegally dumped into oil wells. In addition, California and other western states affected by drought conditions are very aware of the excessive volume of valuable agriculture and/or drinking water used in fossil fuel fracking processes. For these and other reasons, we support House Bill 2711. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Chair Helm and the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Julia DeGraw. I'm the senior Northwest organizer with Food and Water Watch. I'm speaking on behalf of our 38,000 supporters in Oregon State, and we urge you to support House Bill 2711 with the proposed Dash One amendment. Most of my written testimony echoes a lot of what was already said about how fracking threatens communities' drinking water and contributes greatly to climate change. And there are major issues with infrastructure associated with fracking as well, whether it's pipeline failures and things of that nature, not to mention the threat of earthquakes. Something I did want to mention that's not in the written testimony is just giving you a sense of what's happening in other states. In Florida, there is a fracking ban bill that just got voted out of committee with support from Republicans. There's Senate and House versions of a fracking ban in Florida that are both sponsored by Republicans. And in Maryland, there's a fracking ban that's moving forward in the House that just passed out of committee in the House, again, with bipartisan support. So there are states across the country right now that are moving forward with similar proposals to either ban or effectively pass moratoriums on fracking because of their concerns about what will happen with their communities as well. So we're definitely on the right track, and we definitely urge the members of this committee to vote yes on HB 2711.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Helm and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today on behalf of OSEA, the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. We're the state's trade association for solar, and we represent more than 90 companies, large and small, across the state. On behalf of our member companies, OSEA supports House Bill 2711, including the Dash One Amendment. And the moratorium established in the bill would last for the next decade through the year 2027. Over the course of that decade, Oregon is going to see huge growth in other cleaner sources of energy. In the year 2025, 2 years before the moratorium would end, renewable energy sources like wind and solar are slated to be 27% of our electricity supply under Oregon's renewable portfolio standard. And that's for investor-owned utilities. For other large non-investor-owned utilities, we'll be 25% renewable by 2025. And later this month, my organization is going to release a report that lays out a blueprint for how the state, for how solar energy in our state could grow from less than 1% of our electricity supply now to more than 10% by the end of 2025. So given this rapid growth in renewables, the hazards of fracking, and the fact that Oregon has no regulatory regime in place to ensure fracking is safe, we think that it's sensible to adopt this moratorium in alignment with Oregon's existing renewable energy policies. So we support the bill, and thank you very much.
Max, I didn't have you state your full name for the record. So
I'm sorry about that. It's Max Mueller, M-U-L-L-E-R.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up,
sorry. No, you're fine.
They have Greg Peden. Brian Doherty, and Gary Bauer. Welcome. Go ahead, right whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Greg Peden here today on behalf of Cascade Natural Gas. We are opposed to this bill for several reasons. First of all, as been raised by proponents of the bill, I think there's an important argument to be made, and that is in 2015, the Obama EPA published a report on the effects of fracking and groundwater. Their conclusion was that there was no widespread or systematic effects on groundwater from hydraulic fracturing. I think that's an important statement from our national or our federal environmental administrators on that status. Second, if you're somebody who supports rural economic development or somebody who cares about projects like the LNG terminal that's being proposed down in Coos Bay, a part of the state that needs a lot of economic growth and job creation after years of scarcity, you should support fracking. You should support the exploration of natural gas in this country. That project, as many projects around the country in rural parts of the country, are a direct result of the explosion in the last 10 years of this type of work. Finally, if you're opposed to war, if you're opposed to our country's influence and involvement in wars in the Middle East, or believe that we go to war for foreign oil, you should explore and you should support the as much exploration of natural gas and other sources of energy in this country. Ask yourself this: what would the world look like if we were a net exporter of energy in the world? How would that flip the geopolitical dynamics in this world? I'd say it'd be quite a different place. Things like fracking are a direct pipeline, so to speak, to those type of solutions. Finally, as I think this group, this committee knows quite well, as we transition to more and more renewables, there has to be a backup system. Sometimes the sun doesn't shine, sometimes the wind doesn't blow. You have to have something out there that backs up renewables. And I would suggest to you that natural gas, and the more natural gas we have, is the solution to that backup system. Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Brian Doherty, testifying today on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association, whose member companies do explore and produce, refine, market, and transport crude and finished product oil throughout five Western states. They have been safely using hydraulic fracturing for over 60 years. I'll use California as an example. It happens to be quite an earthquake state, and I'll get back to Oklahoma in a moment, but they've done that without any problems in the earthquake related to fracking. What we do have, I want you to call your attention to Ian Mackin's testimony from Dogami. What you heard from others today sounded like you thought this was not a regulated work. Dogami has a fact sheet in there. I submitted one from 2015. Mr. Mackin has updated that to 2017, but it's a sheet shows fracking 101, essentially, to tell you what they're doing. We have three agencies in the state that will be overlooking permitting on any type of fracking, and did so down in the coal bed methane operations that were down in the South Coast. It is highly regulated. We appreciate that. We follow all those regulations. I want to debunk a few things that have been said today. I really appreciate Mr. Peden's testimony about why natural gas is necessary and needed around here, but it's hydraulic fracturing is not an unproven technology. It has been around a long time. Number two, you have statements that it uses excessive amount of water. If you look at the sheet I have in my testimony from California, the average amount a hydrofracking well uses in California is 116,000 gallons a year. That's less than one half of what a golf course uses in one day. if you look at contamination, and I'm going to read some quotes there, but they talk about contamination. You'll find the quotes that I quote from a study done in 2004 by the U.S. EPA found little to no risk of fracturing fluid contaminating underwater sources of drinking water during hydraulic fracturing. Next, in 2011, Lisa Jackson, Secretary of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency under Obama, said, in no case have we made a definitive determination that fracking process has caused chemicals to enter groundwater. She repeated in 2012, hydraulic fracturing has been around for decades, and there's a tremendous amount of misinformation out there about it, a lot of fear that I think is unfounded. In 2013, Gina McCarthy, U.S. EPA Administrator, there's nothing inherently dangerous in fracking that sound engineering practices can't accomplish. Finally, 2013, Sally Jewell, U.S. Secretary of the Interior, after extensive investigations, this has been going on for two decades, and they have looked at this in every way you can imagine. I'm not aware of any proven case where the fracking process itself has affected water quality. So now let's talk about the Oklahoma earthquakes. Fracking does not cause the earthquakes in Oklahoma. What they do is they take the water that comes up with the oil process, and then they drop it back down in the well. Down there, they were in the, I'm trying to remember what formation, but it's the formation below where they pulled out the oil and water that they injected, and it was in a formation below where it was taken out. Typically, and in California, the way they do it, you put it back in where you got it. After you've cleaned the water, you put it back in. And this is what Oklahoma is now finding is the problem, not the fracking itself. And that's easily corrected, and that's what they're doing right now. So with that, I just want to point out also, I think if you're using this map that was given by Dogami showing the Willamette Valley, as a place where fracking may occur, that looks to me to be related to coal bed methane extraction, not natural gas and oil wells. But I would be happy to answer any questions, and I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Chair Helm, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural, local distribution company for natural gas. We purchase our gas from other sources. We do not produce any natural gas. We actually buy two-thirds of our gas from Canada and a third out of the Rockies. Before I go any further, I do want to thank Representative Helm for acknowledging that even though we don't do any hydraulic fracturing at our MIST facility, it is a sandstone type of formation, which doesn't, hydraulic fracturing would not work there. But we do drill, and we actually inject gas back in the ground. It's a primarily depleted gas storage area, and we inject gas back in the ground. We store it there. We draw it back out in order to support our customers' needs during the winter. Hydraulic fracturing has benefited our customers. We actually, because of the volume of gas that's available today, the prices have dropped considerably. That has resulted in our lowering our customers' rates repeatedly over the last few years to the point where they're paying today what they would have paid 15 years ago for natural gas. It's also allowed, I would argue, has allowed the electric utilities to shutter coal plants. And I think you'll find nationally there are no new coal plants being built. And primarily when you ask those folks who do that construction, it's because of the price of natural gas. It's actually cheaper and better to build a natural gas facility and cleaner. We recognize that there are concerns around the process of how you, again, we don't produce it, but we do buy it. So we have worked with the Natural Resources Defense Council on processes and techniques that they think would be better, or at least more environmentally concepts to produce this stuff. If Oregon decides to move forward, and we actually supported Representative Helms' legislation last session to develop some rules, we would bring those forward because we do think there's some rules that you could easily adopt. Not saying that the existing rules don't cover those, but just if you want to have an update. The other thing we are doing, again, as a purchaser of natural gas, we've, again, worked with NRDC on ways of how producers could reduce methane, and we're now exploring, as a customer, how we could take those concepts to producers and when we go out to buy gas and see if they won't implement some of those processes. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Any questions for this panel? Rep. Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill calls for a 10-year moratorium, but the assertion is that what we really need are rules to make sure it's done correctly. If the bill contained a provision that said, if we had these rules, and then the moratorium would end, would you guys support that?
Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, I think we'd take a very serious look at that, yes.
Follow up. Governor Brown in California supports hydraulic fracturing for the reason I think you just mentioned, one of you just mentioned. The purpose is that it keeps oil in the ground. He argues that the availability of the much cleaner natural gas than coal or oil is the proper way to look at the current situation as opposed to perhaps banning the use of this material or trying to get at the non-use of it. And this is to take us to the question of the huge availability of this gas. There's a lot of it. I think when I attended the Lehigh conference this year, it was stated that there are known reserves of almost 200 years of natural gas for the United States, when you look at what can come from Canada or what's already been discovered here. What's the benefit of our subjecting our state to any risk when we can just import it from these other places and let them take the risk?
Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, I think if you're looking at why we are doing this in a state that has no fracking at this time, I would say you're looking at just what you said. We should be using this natural gas as an energy security source. I don't believe you're seeing here from the EPA and the Department of Interior that there's this added risk from hydraulic fracturing versus regular well drilling. And I think what Mr. Bauer has said is accurate, and Mr. Peden. This is energy security, energy independence, and it should be encouraged, and it's done safely. And I think the studies that were done by EPA have shown that to be true.
Final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that the state enjoys a 6% royalty on the production from wells, which goes to the school fund. I don't know if any of you three have checked on that. I did this morning. Does that sound right? None of you know.
I don't know.
Yes. Okay. I believe that's correct.
Thank you. Thanks for action.
Any further questions?
I do need to move along.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And I'm going to, we have one more person to testify on this bill, but I'm going to, right now and open a public hearing on HB 2748 so that Representative Johnson can make his date with the school board in Hood River. He has to leave by 4. So I'm going to close the public hearing temporarily on HB 2711, and I'm going to open the public hearing on HB 2748.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, good to see you from this perspective. For the record, Mark Johnson from House District 52. So House Bill 2748 is about wood stove smoke abatement. You'll recall, I think, when it was early in the session, maybe the first week or two, we had a hearing on a bill that Representative Kenny Geyer had worked on. Related to that, we heard it. We heard from the community of Oak Ridge. We heard from some other folks who testified about how processes had been working in their community and so forth. But I also talked about at the time how I'd been involved, passed a bill in the previous session that led to a session or interim long work group related to the issue. And we know that we need to make some improvements here. We have some issues we need to deal with. The question is, how do we do it without utilizing general funds that we don't really have access to and so forth? How can we help folks in these communities to deal with their issues? So work closely with DEQ on what you see in front of you with House Bill 2748, and specifically I'm talking to the Dash 1 amendments, because this would be a gut and stuff of the original bill. And Rep. Kenny Geyer and I are both now chief co-sponsors of this bill. We've worked together and kind of collaborated on what you see in front of you. But basically, I'll just touch on some highlights, and then I know DEQ has some comments that they'll make as well. But This bill is about trying to direct resources where they're most needed. We have a couple of non-attainment areas for the EPA regarding wood stove smoke emissions in the state. And just to refresh your memory what that means, if you are in a non-attainment area, it makes it very difficult to attract additional business because you have to basically show how you could do that with a zero net impact on emissions and so forth. So what we want to do, obviously, is to prevent that from happening in other areas. And we do have some areas of the state, primarily down in Washington County and so forth, that are on the threshold. So whatever we can do to minimize the chances that they're going to go into a non-attainment status would be very, very important, as you can imagine, being able to attract additional business and industry and so forth. So what this does, it sets up within the existing program at DEQ, there is currently a residential solid fuel heating air quality improvement fund. And this would create a subsector of that. It's called WRAP, or Wood Stove Replacement Assistance Program. And it sets up a fund that can receive contributions from public and private sources, i.e. Washington County could put money into this should they choose to. Intel could put money into this fund if they choose to, because it's in their vested interest to make sure that these parts of their area do not reach non-attainment. From that, then, DEQ can award grants to local organizations that can come in, or groups that can come in and actually perform this kind of work. You'll recall with the Oak Ridge testimony how many of their issues that they have in some of these communities are more than just inefficient wood stoves, but they have homes that could be in need of energy retrofits and so forth too. So in many of our communities across the state, we have community action teams that provide weatherization for low-income residents and so forth. So this would provide an opportunity for groups like that to make a grant proposal to ask with DEQ. So at this point in time, if they're in doing weatherization projects, they could also say, oh, by the way, you've got a clunker wood stove here that is probably a high emitter. What if we replace that while we're in here with a more efficient appliance and so forth? So it's a way to blend these two actions together. And again, it spells out clearly in here, DEQ must first prioritize the awarding of grants first to local programs that serve non-attainment areas that do not comply with the federal standards for particulate matter emissions, and those areas that the department determines are at substantial risk of being designated non-attainment areas due to particulate matter emissions. So that's clearly in the bill, that the first priority is either non-attainment or could become non-attainment areas. Below that, then, DEQ has a menu of options that they can use, i.e. percentage of low-income residents be served by the local program, the amount of other public or private funding be used by the program to leverage the grant, and geographic diversity and so forth. So there are some other details in here that I'll let DEQ go over. But I think, Mr. Chair and committee members, I think this, with the Dash 1 amendments, I think this bill represents, I think, a good conclusion to what really has been a two-session body of work. You know, it takes a while to get this stuff done sometimes, but I think we're at a point where we can say we've done about as much as we kind of can do as a state without just writing out checks out of the general fund to replace these inefficient heating apparatuses. It still gives precedence, and it's sensitive to the needs of local communities. Obviously, the geography creates issues and so forth on this, where the wind doesn't blow, we don't get good air circulation. And I think it's a good bill. So with that, I will be happy to take any questions, but I know we've got Palmer and associates behind us that can fill in any other gaps that I haven't touched on. And I would just add that Representative Geyer and I are both co-chief sponsors of the bill.
Representative Johnson, thanks for your work on this.
You bet.
Appreciate that. Rep. Holby has one question.
Thanks for your work on this. Important issue. Support the program, the replacement program. But, you know, I'm looking at the bill and thinking about Oak Ridge, who I have talked to. And I'm not sure that this bill, and they're in one of those serious non-attainment areas, is going to help them. They were looking for some more flexibility because, if you remember the testimony, they have a pretty poor socioeconomic community that's been impacted by, you know, the decline of some industries, trying to rebuild that community. But one of their big problems is people can't afford the fuel for the replacement stoves and the cost of doing that going forward. And they had a rather unique situation that helped them, which was being able to use monies for cleaner fuel. And though I recognize that this residential solid fuel heating air quality improvement fund is directing money to the replacement program, and it does allow for, I think, up to 30% to be used for other types of programs besides the solid fuel or besides the replacement program, you're requiring that 70% of the grant be used for the replacement program, and that in and of itself sort of tells me that it's not going to work for that particular community that I'm, you know, as far because they're not going to be able to, you know, accomplish that 70% requirement. So I was hoping there'd be a little bit more flexibility for the EQC to award the grant with, you know, communities that are in this similar situation to, you know, look at more fuel-related, I guess, subsidies. Mm-hmm. For cleaner fuels as opposed to the replacement program. So I'm just a little disappointed in that. I know the rest of the state, this may work for, but that particular area I'm not sure is going to hit the mark. Right. So I do have some concerns about that.
Well, I appreciate that, Rep. Holvey, and we have heard from that. I think Senator Przanski indicated some, you know, similar issues. That would be his I would say that, again, I didn't point this out, but up to 30% of these grant funds can be used for education, for helping, you know, folks understand the need to be burning, you know, appropriate stuff in your stove.
Nope.
Here he comes right now. was that kind of up on cue?
It was a nice segue.
Yeah.
We had Representative Johnson over in our committee.
Yeah,
when he
exactly.
left, I started watching. So, okay, I got to get going over here.
So I understand what you're saying. I think might be hard to find that sweet spot. I mean, obviously, I think the main we know that across the vast majority of the state, the main reducing agent is going to be the retiring replacement of these appliances, stoves that are
yep.
polluters. It's just difficult to put a whole lot more. We want to make sure that we're getting the bulk of the resources to where they're going to do the most benefit. But that's why we specifically left, I think, 30% in there that could be used for education and or fuel acquisition or other types of uses as well. So it's really difficult to find that.
And just a quick follow-up, if I may. I appreciate that, and I understand where you're coming from, but you know, for a specific grant for a specific community, I was hoping the EQC would have the flexibility to change that amount as they, you know, saw that a different program may actually work better than the replacement program in reducing wood smoke. So, you know, that just was sort of my thought. And, you know, for most communities, you may be absolutely on target with the 70%, but I don't think it works for this one. But anyway, thanks.
I'm gonna thank you, Representative Johnson. And
thank you, Palmer.
And then I'm gonna invite Palmer and Rachel up, and invite Senator Przanski to make any comments that you'd like to at this time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Thank you very much for taking me out of order so I can get back to the other committee. I'm here, Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4, representing parts of Lane and Douglas County. That does, in fact, include Oak Ridge. Oak Ridge, for those who are not familiar, not only is it in Lane County, it's off Highway 58. It's in the area of the foothills going into Cascades off where Willamette Pass is at. This is an area, as Representative Hovey has stated, has a critical non-attainment area. It has been out of compliance or had been out of compliance for a number of years, working under very strict guidelines to bring it into attainment. The mayor of the city, Jim Coey, has been very instrumental in looking at ways that they can actually address these issues at their local level. And I respect and understand the House Bill 2748 is a means to address many of the issues in other parts of the state. It's not truly a one-size-fits-all, but it is one that really puts a focus on replacement of stoves as the way to address the issue. And I understand with the flexibility of 70-30 that in many cases it would allow for many communities to be able to have the let's say the flexibility that they would need, but it will not do what needs to be done for Oak Ridge. We had did reach out and asked to see whether or not we could come to some resolution as to maybe having a carve-out that would be for cities of, say, the size, population of 5,000 or less, could be adjusted up or down a little bit on that. But we're thinking communities of 5,000 or less should be able to have an opportunity to have more flexibility than just really focusing on the replacement of the stoves. Oak Ridge, and I'm not sure if you've heard this testimony from the mayor or any other representatives, the programs that I'm familiar with is one that is based on the fuel, the firewood. They have, over the last 2 years, if I'm not mistaken, fire seasons, have had an agreement and have received wood that they actually go through in great detail to dry, split dry, and maintain it to the point of keeping it until it is thoroughly ready to be used in the stoves for individuals that will have a cleaner burning than having green wood. They also use education, and they also have had a lot of success in the regulatory enforcement by having a code officer. And this is a situation where they actually are using the code officer to assist individuals that are in, that have limited means, having wood stoves as their primary heat, how they can actually be better at being efficient, and at the same time where they can, they've done some replacement with Douglas heat stove, and I understand that the bill itself would allow for that, but that's only one of the components. As you, I think many of you know, that who represent more rural areas, there's many historical and heritage perspectives of individuals, and some people would say, you know, their wood stoves are right there as part of their generational upbringing, and this is how they want to continue to act. So it's by having a carve-out, we would ask this committee to look at an additional amendment that would allow for cities of, I'll submit, 5,000 or less, to be able to have a different ratio of 75-25, 75 for flexibility, and the other 25 into the basis of the bill that's before you today, to allow them to actually continue to be successful in what they've been able to do. And they have, in fact, taken themselves out of being in the red zone of the eyes of DEQ, EPA through DEQ. And so that's one of the things we would ask you to consider. Thank you very much for your time and allowing me to put some comments on the record.
Thank you, Senator. We'll let you go back to your
thank
other
you.
Committee. Thanks. And Palmer and Rachel, what I think I might do, instead of having you march through the amendments today, is to just have you answer any questions from committee members that we might have, and then when we come back and take this up in a work session, we'll have a more thorough understanding and of the amendments. And I want to thank both of you for working on those with Representative Johnson. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Page 5, line 20. This is simply a lack of knowledge on my part. What is a vent-free heating appliance that is accepted under this provision?
So, Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, a vent-free heating... Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, yep. My name is Rachel Sakata. I'm the Air Quality Planner with the Florida Department of Environmental Quality. Regards to your question about what is a vent-free heating appliance, so it would be... How do I describe it? sort of like those electric-type heaters that you can put in to your home. It's something that we work with the Oregon Hearth Patio Barbecue Association to make sure that there are safety concerns about putting these kinds of devices in fire issues. So that's why it's worded that way.
Well, if I could follow up. We heard testimony from the mayor of Oak Ridge on the other bill when he was here a month ago, I think. And one of the things that he talked about was installing heat pumps that do not have vents but instead use a heat exchanger on the inside of the house. Again, no vents. Is this a provision intended to apply to that kind of appliance?
Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, no. Ductless heat pumps have been
thank
really
you.
Effective.
That was the word I was trying to think of, ductless.
Yes.
And ductless heat pump is not covered by the words vent-free heating appliance.
That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions from the committee right now? Representative Holby.
Just a clarification. So I recognize that there's the residential solid fuel heating air quality improvement fund, and I'm trying to discern whether the monies in that fund go to this newly created replacement program in entirety, or what else can currently under this Dashboard amendment could those funds be used for?
Chair Helm, Representative Holby, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative advisor for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. To your question, Representative Holby, what this is intended to do is add basically a specific grant program within the confines of that fund, and for the sake of keeping it short, I'll call it the Residential Solid Fuel Fund. Within that fund, create a specific grant program that would be managed by DEQ, where we would award grants to local governments, regional air authorities, and nonprofits. Standing alone and separate from that, the fund would be eligible to receive dollars, be they appropriated by the legislature. And this is something that I think Representative Johnson alluded to, but just to be clear for the record, in this amendment, there's also language that would allow that fund to take dollars from any public or private source and receive those dollars. So you have sort of the residential solid fuel heating fund standing there. It can take now money, if this legislation and this amendment were adopted, from any source, public or private. And that fund allows the department to use money for replacement, for planning efforts, for outreach and education. It's a broader approach to the strategies you need around managing and reducing smoke. And then within this, within that fund, there is now a specific program that's set up that would get a specific appropriation for the legislature. Hopefully that answers your question.
Follow up, and I'm sorry if I'm taking too much time. I'm more concerned about the use of the fund, and so I understand that you can do education and a few other things, but beyond that, it appears that the monies go into this grant program pretty much. If I don't see where you could use this for instance, cleaner fuel. Unless it actually came out of the replacement program.
So, Chair Hem, Representative Holby, I may be a little bit redundant here, but just to be clear, so on page 12, that section 9, that's what whatever amount is specified in the budget bill, I presume DEQ's budget bill, to go to this to the overall fund, this language would tie it to the grant program. So just to be clear about that.
Well, I guess that was what I would follow up, Mr. Chair. That's what I was trying to understand, because it looks like that the existing fund is now, the monies in it are going to be tied to this replacement program. And that's not
the case here.
Okay.
So that grant program, that local grant program, would only be funded by the operation of Section 9 in this amendment, and then whatever the legislature appropriates in a budget bill. And then the fund itself would still be, exist on the books, as it were, and it would be eligible to receive dollars from any public or private source. Aren't dollars in it.
I'm just trying to understand what you're going to use the monies in that fund for.
I think the intent there was, as Representative Johnson was explaining, he wanted to see that, in particular, the private sector could contribute dollars to helping to solve this problem, because it's, as he said, it's in their interest. So the solid fuel fund was tweaked to allow money from any source, again, public or private.
I got that. Where the money you can receive. I'll take this offline.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you both very much for being here today. I appreciate it. And at this time, I'm going to close the public hearing for
2748 temporarily. I've got some folks, some other folks that are signed up to testify, but I really need to get to our next bill because we have folks from out of town. And I'm going to try to get their bill done right now. So I'm going to close the public hearing for House Bill, or I'm going to recess the hearing for House Bill 2748. And I'm going to open the public hearing for House Bill 2485. Representative Bentz, are you going to give this a kickoff? And on, Representative Bentz, did you want to have...
Yes.
Mark Webb and Jerry Nicolescu, come on forward. We're right ahead when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, Cliff Vance, State Representative District 60. Thank you for hearing this bill. The concept underlying the bill is pretty simple. The idea is that when you have a diversion in a river or stream, there may be good reasons to replace it with more fish-friendly devices. And if you look at some of the testimony, the pictures that have been submitted are just excellent and really illustrate the situation well. Mark Webb's testimony online. So for this hearing, but having been raised on a ranch that had five or six of these diversions in the Middle Fork of the Malheur, I'm extremely familiar with exactly the issue that this bill attempts to address. The concept is that if someone wants to put in a fish screen, you generally need a faster flow of water. So to achieve that, you move further up the stream to your point of diversion. So you move your dam upstream. Well, that's all mighty fine as long, under current regulations, as long as you're within 500 feet of the existing point of diversion, then nobody particularly cares, generally. Depends on whose other points of diversion are between yours and that 500-foot spot, but for the sake of this illustration, I'll just assume there are none. What's been happening, though, is that we've had to move, in certain circumstances, the point of diversion further than 500 feet, one way or the other. And so this then opens the door to a much longer process, a portion of which causes landowners concern, because many of these ranches and farms have been there for literally over 100 years, and no one quite knows if the original water right map matches where the water is actually being used. In fact, it would be a miracle if it did. And so most people say, you know what, I think we'll just pass on that fish passage improvement and go right on doing things the way we always have. And so the Grant County Soil and Water Conservation District, recognizing the problem, brings this bill. Now, this bill is not complete. There's an amendment being crafted for it that addresses a number of the issues that I see that Water Watch and others have raised, and they're good issues. I'm glad they raised them. This is a bill that's been brought by the Soil and Water Conservation District without the help of high-priced lawyers, and that's why we welcome the assistance of other attorneys from other organizations and look at some of those proposed changes.
Okay, you're going to recess your meeting.
Committee.
The rate of rise today.
And I don't believe that I recessed that public hearing.
Yeah, you did.
Okay, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2485. We're all good. Please continue, Representative Pence.
Chair, so as I was saying, there is an amendment to this bill, which is certainly a necessary part of the bill if it's going to move forward, and we anticipate that we'll have it in the next week, within the next week. We are more than happy to discuss the changes, as I indicated previously, with those who have concerns about the bill. And in fact, this is for the benefit of for not necessarily fish passage, but also flows for fish. So many times when you make these adjustments, it's not only the barrier to the fish that is improved, but also the flow of water in the space that previously was dewatered. For example, you can combine ditches on occasion and thus not only remove barriers, but replace water in the stream where it didn't used to be. So this is, I'm very familiar with all this because my family has done it. The intent of this bill is to try to prompt people who otherwise would be not willing to go forward because of the fear of having to have a survey or something else to make sure they were actually using their water in the right place, and they're simply not going to go through that kind of expense. So the idea here is to create an alternative to the transfer process, which is very narrowly prescribed. We've put a couple of things in the amendments. We want to limit this to the John Day Basin. So there's just only this basin as we try this out. It's already limited to 10 years. The concept being that this is a new idea, and when you tread in the water law arena, you want to tread extremely carefully. So the concept is let's do the amendment, get everybody's thinking on it, bring it back for your further consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank
you. Go right ahead, whoever's ready.
Chairman Hale, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Nicolescu. I am the executive director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, and we fully support the concepts embodied in House Bill 2485 and any proposed amendments. We've been aware of those discussions going on. This bill does a number of things. It provides the landowner the ability to implement conservations voluntarily and to keep doing that. Yet it provides the ability to refit diversion to structures so they're environmentally friendly as well as effective to the landowner's operation. It continues to allow for the measurement and flow measurements so that we can to meet current statutes. It's maintenance of the landowner's water right and the acreage to be irrigated. It will not cost the state anything. The projects themselves are generally funded through other programs with the federal government. It also provides for a sufficient amount of time for landowners to assess their operations and look at this and build them into their operations and look at the feasibility of that as they move ahead and to assess, and it gives it time to assess the impact of this possibility on the environment and fish passage and water flow. It also encourages other landowners at the local level and agencies and others to work together to do this. This is built very much at the local level and comes forward this way. And we very much would like you to consider this because that's the way things are done best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Helm, thank you. My name is Mark Webb, Grant County, former county judge there, currently executive director for Blue Mountains Forest Partners. We're an organization that works with the Malheur National Forest to do a lot of restoration work. And for my part, I just wanted to put this effort in that larger context. We've been pretty successful on the Malheur in Grant County, which is a really challenging area to be. We've done that by identifying the desired conditions as well as the landscape needs and seeing how we can best, as environmentalists and industry folks, address those. And this bill is addressing a restoration context. It is about restoration, and I can't emphasize that enough. And we have a good sense of what restoration needs there are in the John Day Basin in terms of flow, in terms of fish passage. We understand what that involves for the landowners and the water right holders. And so I just can't encourage y'all enough to support this because this bill really does better align the existing legal framework. And the legal framework made a lot of sense in the past. Things change. But it better aligns the existing legal framework with the social and economic realities of restoration work. There's a lot of resistance on the part of locals to agencies doing anything, a lot of suspicion. This helps address that. It also lowers the cost. In terms of the photos that y'all saw that we sent or submitted the other day, if you look on the front page, the bottom left-hand corner, a small fish passage, that's an $88,000 structure. And you look on the next page where you've just got natural ripples, considerably cheaper, a lot more natural, a lot more fish friendly. So I just can't stress that enough. And then lastly, and that does address the conditions on the ground, it really is smart a lot of times to move the POD upstream more than 500 feet. If you do that, that kicks into existence certain requirements that really do disincentivize landowner participation. And this bill wants to address that. So it is restoration oriented, sensitive to the needs of the agencies, ODF&W, OWRD, sensitive to the needs of the water right holders, but it really does target fish passage flow issues in a way that brings those things together nicely. So can't encourage y'all enough to consider it seriously.
Thank you very much. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming today. I've got two folks signed up to testify, Kimberly Priestley and Tom Wolf.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly Priestley, and I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch is a river conservation group that works to restore and protect stream flows statewide. First, I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2485. While Water Watch is supportive of fish passage projects, and we do think that some of the projects outlined by proponents are very compelling, we do have concerns with the bill as drafted, as well as the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments. That said, we have talked to bill proponents and have worked through many of the issues that are contained in our written comments. However, there are still a few that we're still discussing. The point being is I think there needs to be more discussions, and I understand that there will be further amendments offered on this. Rather than go through all the points in our written testimony, I thought I would just quickly highlight to me would appear to be the couple issues that are a little more difficult to address. And these are related primarily to key sideboards of the transfer statutes or rules that currently apply to changes in point of diversion but would not apply to these class of applicants. Specifically, there are just actually two areas that I will highlight. The bill would not require that the applicant provide evidence that water has been used over the past 5 years in compliance with the terms and conditions of the water right, or that the water right is not subject to forfeiture. And we're concerned about this because proof of water use is critical to ensuring that the proposed change in point of diversion will not result in an increase of water use or revival of a water right that might otherwise be subject to forfeiture. Similarly, and this is somewhat connected to the last point, the bill also fails to require to include a requirement that the applicant provide a description of the current water delivery system that demonstrates that the applicant is ready, willing, and able to exercise the right. And that includes like information on the pumps, canals, pipelines, things of that sort. This information is also important to ensuring that the water use at the new point of diversion will not exceed that of the old point of diversion. And I guess the basic point there, I mean, the root of our concern is that without requiring information on past use and or the capacity of the diversion, our concern is that, you know, again, is that the diversion at the new point could divert more water than at the original point of diversion, which could have negative effects on fisheries and other aquatic species. And while I do appreciate that the bill calls for an injury review, having information on current use and the current delivery system is important to making that determination. Excuse me. And finally, not all streams are protected by in-stream water rights, so that review would not necessarily be an all-encompassing review of the effect of a increased use on a stream that doesn't have an in-stream water right. In other words, the injury review would not catch that what could be a negative effect on fisheries. I will keep this short. Let's see. And I guess I'll just end with that, and I'll say again, you know, many of the concerns that we raised in our testimony, I think we have worked through with bill proponents, and we're very thankful for that. And we just hope, you know, we would like to continue discussions, and hopefully we will be able to resolve these two points in a way that would, you know, alleviate concerns about the impacts on fisheries. And with that, I will take any questions.
All right, go ahead and get Tom's testimony, and then we'll open it up.
Chair Helm, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm here representing Trout Unlimited, And many of you heard the spiel that I usually share about our numbers after this, so I'll avoid that. But we are a cold water conservation group, and one of our areas that we really work hard on is in-stream flows, fish passage. Currently, we have within our state 12 national staff members and 3,200 members working on this, primarily in Klamath Basin, Central Oregon, and Northeast Oregon on the Umatilla and Grand Ronde. And one of the things we try to do is work voluntarily with landowners on in-stream flow issues, on fish passage issues. So we look at HB 2485 with a great amount of interest. And I've got to say also, as a member of the American Fisheries Society, the professional group for fishery biologists, I'm interested in this, what this bill has to say. But we share also Water Watch's and some of the agency concerns about this bill, and want to see those addressed. Having said that, it's encouraging to talk to Kimberly and realize that the proponents of this bill are trying desperately to work out this issue so that they can be addressed and this bill can go forward. If we try to limit it, can be of any service in working with the proponents of this bill to make sure that the concerns, both in our written testimony and Water Watch's testimony and the Water Resources Department's testimony, can be addressed. We will be supportive of this bill because we think it has a great possibilities to deal with delicate fish passage issues in a very arid part of the state, Eastern Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you. And thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I'm curious because I'm probably just a member of the Representative Bent's fan club, because when he does something, he's very thorough and he's very thorough and he thinks it through. And this, it just appears to me, I have not read this bill completely through, and I don't have my computer to see the testimonies in full, but I've also, in my past life when I was county commissioner and then living where I do, I've been involved with soil and water conservation districts and Northwest Regionals, Northwest, you know those guys.
Yeah.
And you know who I mean.
Yeah.
And these programs are, to me it sounds like people are trying to improve on fish passage. And it just seems like asking, and they're very thorough, and they have to, anytime you get federal money involved in anything, it's a lot of paperwork and things like that. So I'm just kind of curious, wanting to have a bunch more information, and maybe is it necessary to have all this information when what it sounds like they're trying to do is to find a way to make this fish passage project a better one? I mean, nobody's making them do this. Hmm.
Chair Helm, Representative Boone, that's a very good question. And I guess I will say that the law right now does provide some leeway for fish-friendly projects. For instance, it allows the department, both in the proof of use at the application stage and then at the certification stage, to either waive or help the applicant with the mapping requirement. And so that does alleviate some of the burden you are speaking of. And then when it comes to proof of use, the rules on that actually, it's actually not that onerous. I mean, things that could be supplied include an affidavit of an NRCS employee, farm agency reports, documents from districts or NRCS, even affidavits of the owner. So it's I guess the point I would like that I'm trying to make is that under existing law, there are provisions that already allow help to folks who want to engage in fish-friendly projects. And again, our concern, we very much support, the type of projects that have been brought to light today. It's our concern really is focused on the possible unintended consequences of a decrease in flows because of a point of diversion change where you're not sort of checking your boxes on what was used at the old point of diversion versus what was used at the new point of the diversion. And so, you know, we're very open if bill proponents or others feel that the provisions in existing law are still too onerous. I mean, that may be something that we can talk about. But we would still feel that the information is important for that determination.
Follow up. Well, I have a 1938 prior 38 water right, mm-hmm. and I have seen it. Some other agencies, people, et cetera, abscond with it. And having to prove use in one thing, I know some of my neighbors have had this happen too. There was a year when ODF&W went down the whole list and applied for all the water rights. And if you didn't defend yours, you lost it. And I'm very aware of that, and I'm very aware of putting more onerous requirements on people who are really just trying to do a good project. And I see what you're saying about that, about, you know, the point of diversion might, you know, if it's somewhere else, it might take more than the other one did. But I would think that they would check that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it just seems like this is really getting down in the weeds and requiring a lot of stuff. I think you're going to end up disincentivizing people to do something that's a good thing to do just by piling on more requirements of busy work, basically.
Chair Helm, Representative Boone, and it's good to see you also. So speaking for my group, and I can't speak for Water Watch Trout Unlimited, we... Like I said, I didn't come here to oppose this bill, just to support some of the concerns of the agencies and others. But I would like to see this bill go forward because I was born and raised in Eastern Oregon for over half my youth. So and plan on after I retire this summer, and I threw in the retirement thing, to move back to Wallowa County. So. Obviously, I'd like to see this work, and I don't want to discourage anything. I just think that there are ways that we can all work together to make sure that the concerns that are expressed here can be done. I certainly don't want to see this bill died. I don't want to see, in creative people squashed. So whatever way my organization can work to make sure this bill goes forward, we're willing to do it.
Any further questions at this time? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. That finishes the public testimony for HB 2485. So I'm going to close the hearing on HB 2485. And folks, given our timing, so if you're here to talk about HB 2471, I'm going to carry it over. We just don't have enough time to give that topic the attention that we need to today. So I'm going to carry over HB 2471 to the Monday, March 13 agenda.
No, we have.
And I'm also carrying over, that'll do.
We can do
it. You can do the work session.
Yeah.
It's just the work session.
And I would like to do a work session here pretty quick as soon as we get Representative Bentz back on House Bill 2331. And then I'm going to get to the folks that wanted to talk about wood smoke, and that'll finish up our hearing. Is the representative from Central Oregon Land Watch still here? Yeah. Why don't you come forward right now? We'll get you while we're waiting for Representative Bentz. So I'm going to reopen the hearing on HB 2711 and hear from Thomas Mosher.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Thomas Mosher. I'm here representing Central Oregon Land Watch. I'll be exceedingly brief. We join in support with the others on House Bill 2711. Good bill should pass. About it. Thanks.
Central Oregon, but...
Very good. Any questions from Mr. Mosher?
Thanks.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate it. And with that, I can close the public hearing on HB 2711. And committee, I'd like to go ahead and open the work session on HB 2331. So I'm opening that now, opening a work session on House Bill 2331. And is there any, the representative from Department of Administrative Services provided additional information. It's on OLIS. And I believe that the committee is ready to vote. So with that, do I have a motion?
Chair Helm, I move HB 2331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Vance? Aye.
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative
Rushkey? Aye.
Representative Brocksmith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson? Okay.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair
Hunter? Aye. Okay. House Bill. So House Bill 2331 passes and. Need to assign a carrier. How about, would you like to do that?
I'd be happy to carry it. Yeah.
Okay.
I think I may be responsible for it from some remote year when we pass the press. I can't remember, to be honest with you.
Well, that's a good enough reason for me.
But I'm happy to carry it.
Thank you. Okay, yeah. Representative Vance will carry that bill out on the floor. Very good.
It's his fault.
And then we're going to, last thing I'm going to do today is reopen, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2748 and invite Jim McCauley, Tracy Rudin, and Alex up, if Alex is still here. Okay, come on forward. Happy to have your testimony on this issue.
Chair Hale, members of the committee, I can make this really quick. Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. We just got the amendments for this bill just a little bit before the hearing and had a chance to read through them. I want to thank Representative Barnhart for picking up on, I think, an unintended consequence in terms of not being able to use this for a vent-free system. I don't think that was the intent. The work that we do in Washington County, essentially once it meets a high-efficiency standard and low emissions, it qualifies within the system, and I think that's ultimately the intent. So I think that'll be easy to pick that up. The rest of the bill we're fine with. Maybe one offer within the Oak Ridge concern is if there's a way to figure out drafting this to allow something that would apply directly to Oak Ridge and get that problem fixed. We're not going to have any problem with that as well.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, Tracy Rutten, League of Oregon Cities. I'll be very brief today. You've already heard our testimony previously on the issue more generally of wood smoke issues and those issues which impact a number of our communities, including having had the mayor of Oak Ridge up here to testify about the experience they've had in that community. I want to thank Representative Johnson and Representative Kenny Geyer, as well as previous sponsors of other legislation we've looked at, because we really do see this as a critical issue to try and find some additional funding and some path forward to address the concerns that these local communities, and many of them being smaller communities, have faced. But it's really not an issue that discriminates. There's larger communities at play here. We would support additional flexibility. And again, it was our understanding that ductless heat pumps would be included. We would support that as well. One other issue I'll bring up, and we'll have a conversation with Representative Johnson about, is the 10% restriction on the ability of a community to use funds for administrative costs. Some of these communities are really quite small, and when they're looking at cutting staff for a number of other services, we want to make sure that if they're going to engage in a program that includes changeouts, that they're not having to do some sort of shift within their limited resources to be able to actually have staffing to support that. So we want to make sure that they have adequate staffing taken care of as part of the grant program. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Chair Helm and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. And I think I previously testified on your bill, Chairman Helm, with respect to some policy issues that Lane County had been involved with to try to assist Oak Ridge with respect to impacts that are coming from outside of the urban growth boundary, outside of the city limits, but within the urban growth boundary up in Oak Ridge. And This issue about Oak Ridge is actually on one of our lists of priorities for the session, and I just wanted to briefly explain why. And that is that in some places you can have a county like Lane be considered entirely urban due to its urban center, but it's a very big place. It's as large as the state of Connecticut. And so sometimes these rural areas get painted as an urban area in this thing called a metropolitan statistical analysis or something like that, that does cause that. In this case, we're actually, the urban area is getting painted with this non-attainment area up in Oak Ridge. So 3,300 residents up in Oak Ridge paint the entirety of the county when it comes to things like county health rankings. And so that's why we're really interested in trying to make sure that Oak Ridge is assisted here, and have asked for this little bit more dispensation with respect to the flexibility in the bill, because it's very important for Lane County as a whole, the almost 400,000 residents, to really see Oak Ridge be able to succeed in staying out of the non-attainment status for the next 10 years, is which they will be monitored for. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for this panel? Very good. Thank you for sticking with me and to the end of the hearing to get your testimony in. With that, I can close the public hearing on House Bill 2748. I think that is all the business in front of us today, committee, so I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Energy and Environment.